Question three. When the Hawaiian Revolution occurred, the bloodless revolution that placed the Queen under house arrest occurred, conveniently, an American gunboat dispatched Marines at that time in 1893 to make sure it went successful. What was the name of that American gunboat? That's coming. I think it's coming. Should have come. Anyway, not that one. Question four. Name the Spanish counterinsurgency tactician who was sent by Spain to crush the Cuban Revolution. His efforts involved rounding up civilians and putting them into concentration camps, trying to torture the names of the leaders of the rebellion out of them. Instead of squashing the rebellion, it caused it to spread further, and he was recalled by Spain. Questions 5 and 6. Answers can go in either order. Name the two most prominent New York Yellow Press journalists who helped inflame passions against the Spanish in their two publications, The New York World and The New York Journal, in the late 1890s. Yes. Name the two New York newspaper publishers, Yellow Press journalists, who helped inflame passion against the Spanish in the late 1890s in their newspapers, The New York World and The New York Journal. Yes, last name's always sufficient unless I ask for a first name. In fact, it's safer to not put a first name to make sure. So, say the question on a quiz someday would be, you know, who won the 2008 election? And you just wrote Clinton. Should you have to clarify with Hillary, or would that be sexist? You should have to clarify?
Yeah.
Although they never made Bill have to clarify. Of course, there was only one of them then. So I guess if there's two different names, then we have to clarify. But if it's a female, we shouldn't have to clarify just because it's a female.
Well, don't they do that now?
They do. That was my point. That was my point.
Right. That
if you hear just a last name, you assume automatically it's the male part of the relationship. So that is kind of... Anyway, that's not what we're doing. Question 7. This 1901 congressional amendment to the Paris Peace Treaty of 1898 declared that although Cuba was independent, there would be some restrictions, which included preventing Cuba from borrowing money from European banks, defaulting on those loans, and causing America to have to come to their aid. Also, that Cuba would become a military protectorate of the American defense zone. And third, that the United States would have the right to set up a naval base in Cuba. What was this 1901 amendment to the Paris Peace Treaty of 1898? Question 8, related to question 7, what current naval base do we still occupy that came from answer 7?
You don't grade based on spelling rule.
Our spelling rule is always this: when we pronounce your answer out loud, if it sounds correct, it is correct. So one time we had a quiz, and the answer was Nikita Khrushchev, and going only with last name, they spelled it C-R-E-W-S, second word C-H-E-F, and it was correct. Question 9. The Secretary of State for both McKinley and later Theodore Roosevelt, he described the Spanish-American War, insensitively I might add, as a splendid little war. Who was he? Question 10. April 18th, 1898, 1 week after declaring war on Spain, Congress added an amendment to the War Declaration which claimed that this war was to free Cubans, not to annex Cuban soil. What was this amendment to the War Declaration called? Question 11. Of those who had to search their souls to decide which way on the debate over annexation of the Philippines they would land, one person, an influential person, is said to have prayed all night and came to the realization that we must civilize, uplift, and Christianize the Filipinos. Who was this politician? Who would later be shot, by the way. Question 12. How much money did the United States pay Spain for the Philippines? Question 13. Name the prominent Filipino revolutionary who not only assisted Dewey on ousting the Spanish from the Philippines in 1898, but then later, from 1899 through 1903, led a resistance movement against the United States. Still alive in 1946, fighting the Japanese. And let's add a 14th question just for fun here. The mysterious explosion of what gunboat was probably the greatest factor that dragged us immediately into war with Spain? That's such a good question. I don't know why I wasn't there to start with. Any repeats?
Yes, can you repeat 5 and 6?
Yeah, 5 and 6 are named the two prominent New York newspaper publishers, Yellow Press sensationalists, who through their newspapers, the New York World and the New York Journal, inflamed passions against the Spanish in the late 1890s. 3 is what gunboat assisted the Hawaiian Revolution by the dispatching of Marines in 1893. 2 is a former ship captain who wrote the book The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, published in 1890, advocating a strong navy and island bases around the world. Quiz 3. That's pretty accurate, isn't it? That'll actually be the easiest way for me to keep up with it. 10. Thank you for the title, too. I'm glad you asked that. 10 is what amendment to the War Declaration passed by Congress on April 18th claimed this war is only to free Cubans, not to annex land such as Cuba? 13 is the prominent Filipino revolutionary who fought the Spanish and the Americans between 1898 through 1903. If nothing else, then we'll pick them up.
Do these quizzes help?
The hope would be is that there's a certain element of terror that's always lurking. So therefore, you kind of study more than once, and then after you do that the night before the test, you don't have to worry because you already know it all. Or at least you know the factual material.
Do we need answers? Every time I used to say, do you want to hear the truth? And someone yelled out, you can't handle the truth. Remember that movie? Where was it? Where was part of that movie set? That's right.
What was question number 11?
Question 11 was, who was the person who searched his soul about which way he really adhered? He knew all along which way. Whether to annex the Philippines or not, and said that after praying on his knees, he came to the realization that we must uplift civilized... McKinley, yes. So you still got perfect. If you missed two, you still got perfect. You got all the electoral votes you could out of that. So. Yeah, question one, Josiah Strong wrote Our Country. Alfred Thayer Mahon wrote The Influence of Sea Power Upon History. The Boston assisted the Hawaiian Revolt. Weyler was the counterinsurgency tactician that tried to suppress the Cuban Revolution. Hearst, William Randolph Hearst, and Pulitzer, Joseph Pulitzer, were the two most prominent publishers. The Platt Amendment was the one that provided for the Guantanamo Bay, which is number 8, naval base. John Hay was the Secretary of State that advocated a splendid little war. The Teller Amendment said we're not going to annex land. McKinley, as we saw, was the one who made those claims. 20 million for the Philippines. Aguinaldo, or Emilio Aguinaldo, the Filipino revolutionary leader, and the battleship Maine was the one that exploded, causing the conflict. So all trying to make all as much as possible, like everything a proper noun on the quiz. And yes, that's all you can get. There's no welfare beyond 10, so. You know, that would be like saying, if we got enough popular vote, if we got more popular vote than we need for this electoral state, can we spill that popular vote over to the next quiz of state? And I think really the way I work is I try to make simple, short answer, one word, two word answers be the answers on the quizzes. And then on the multiple choice tests, what I do is I just look at, like, for example, Alfred Thayer Mahon, and if I was making a question, I'd say, well, okay, I can either make him into question and make the book title the answer, I can make him the answer, or I can make a concept the answer. So if I was going for a little bit tougher question, I'd say Alfred Thayer Mahon, in his book The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, advocated, and then four answers would be, you know, join the Democratic Party, two might be return to a wooden navy, and then finally, that's the hardest part about a test is trying to come up with wrong answers that are persuasive enough. It seems like when you're building a test, that right answer just stands out. Those wrong answers look so hokey. You can try your best to make, because if you try to make it hard, then it looks even hokier. It's obvious. People can tell it even faster. So it's really hard to make a hard test. So make your own test, and pretty soon you'll think of the same questions I do. I guess my mind is so simple. I
never looked that obvious to me.
But it is. It's three things, right? It's either the person or the title of something is in the answer, or what the thing is about is the answer, or the only other choice left is if there's like three provisions to a treaty, which of the following is not part of so-and-so treaty? That's all you. That's really all you have left to do. So. And that's all history courses, so you've got them all down right there. Well, we left off at 20 what? 29. Oh, okay. That's. I left a name of something off that I want to mention again. When I was talking about the question concerning people who live in these acquired islands, whether it's the Philippines, Guam, Wake, Puerto Rico, in the early years, but from the turn of the century up to about 1911, 1913, in this question of whether or not people living in this American territory are citizens and have the rights of citizenship, I said that the Supreme Court, through a number of cases, finally came to the conclusion, no, they don't. That they are under the jurisdiction of, but not citizens of, which is really a complete violation of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment says if you're living under the jurisdiction of, I guess it's not if you weren't born or naturalized, if you were just stolen as people, I guess they wouldn't. But it's not in keeping with the spirit of the 14th Amendment. They were considered not citizens. And, of course, we know the reasons why is because they're of different ethnic and social background. And full citizenship would have meant migration opportunities and competition for jobs. But what I left out of that discussion was the names of those cases were called the insular cases, I-N-S-U-L-A-R. Insular meaning related to islands. So we're on item 30 now. We had had an interest in trading in China since the 1820s and 30s. And by the 1840s, we'd even negotiated treaties with China to gain what's called most favored nation status. Most favored nation status means that if you've received that, that means you get all the benefits of diplomacy that's given to any other country. So, like, for example, let's say that we grant free trade to France and free trade to Brazil, but everybody else that trades in our markets have to pay taxes or tariffs. If we were to come along and open up a newer relationship with, say, Ghana, and offer them most favored nation status, then that means the best of all the privileges that we give other nations, we would give Ghana. So we had demanded most favored nation status from China to make sure that we have the best trade opportunities. One of the strategies that China tried was to give every single other nation most favored nation status also. So really, China's at the mercy of everybody all at once. But the reason behind this is, if they gave everybody access to the markets, the belief as the 1840s, 1860s, and 1870s go onward is that all the competition from Europe and abroad and from the United States will be so fierce that no one nation can be strong enough to conquer China. China realized they didn't have the military power to defend themselves, so their hopes were competitive markets might keep a balance of power to protect them. Instead, what happens is each of these nations except us, each of these major European nations, including Japan, carve out what are called spheres of influence. So they go in and they kind of semi-occupy and conquer maybe the city of Shanghai or maybe Port of Tianjin or maybe Port Arthur Province. And so various, mainly coastal areas would be put under the quasi-authority of Italy or Japan or Russia or Britain, which is something we didn't do. Now, even though we just got through acquiring lands in the Spanish-American War, in the 1890s we disdained what was going on in China as being imperialistic and something we were beyond and above. But as the 1890s start to come to the close of the century, it looks like these spheres of influence are growing strong enough and numerous enough that we may be completely cut out of the trade. So in response to that, in 1899, John Hay, the Secretary of State we mentioned earlier, he sends a series of letters to the leaders of Europe and Japan and Russia, warning them that their spheres of influence should not become so impacted and so powerful that the United States is denied any market access. And in those letters, he demanded that the door to China remain open. From those letters and later from a public policy announcement, this came to be known as the open door policy. So the open door policy is we claim that free access to China and trade must remain available to us. No one foreign power has the authority to carve up China and prevent us from trading. Now, what follows after that, I guess, is the unsaid threat that if you do, you face American military power. That if they did try to close off access to trade, it's not said, but it's implied that you face American military power to do so. They being the Europeans, the Russians, the Japanese, who are threatening the sovereignty of China. Now, in 1899, did we have the... Okay, let me run through this a little bit again, because obviously I've done a good job of confusing everybody.
Who wrote the letters to the agents?
No, there's where I made the mistake of it.
Okay.
What I meant to say, no matter what I did say, was that John Hay sent diplomatic notes to, like, Bismarck or to the Prime Minister of England or the President of France or the Tsar of Russia. And in these letters to the Japanese, Russian, and European governments, he says, as you build your spheres of influence in China, don't go so far as to cut us out, that we can't have access. And he further is saying, whether it's in words or whether it's in meaning, is you will face the American military if you try to carve up China. So the way this was promoted was that we are the protector of China. We're going to guarantee Chinese integrity and sovereignty from all these outsiders. But the reason for it is because we don't want to lose the commercial markets that are there. So it's our classic theme again. Are we involved in a foreign policy move for our own greed, or are we in it for protect the integrity of others who are endangered? And it's a both. We got a frown there saying, like police, but wait a minute now. Wait a minute. Did we have a sphere of influence in China? No. So doesn't that make us look a little bit more honorable than those who had conquered a city or a province? But we're still acting like we did in Cuba. We're still acting like whether China wants it or not, we'll throw our weight around to defend them. Henry Chai, who teaches at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, I had for graduate courses, undergraduate courses, as early as 1972, and he's still up there teaching. He, in a lecture on this, commented that the open door policy was announced because we got there so late we didn't get to steal any markets, so therefore we would look like the protectorate. And that bothered me for many, many years, you know. And I thought that is so anti-American sounding. That's because he's from Taiwan. That's why he says those things. And great instructor, wonderful guy. But I did some reading, and I never found anything to prove that. So I cling, maybe naively, to that belief that there was a certain sincerity there, that we really wanted to be protecting China's territorial integrity while conveniently keeping our markets available. Yes, territorial integrity, keeping China one nation rather than carved up. So how effective were the open door notes? How effective was the open door policy? Well, it gets challenged in item 32. Before I get to 32, though, let me comment about 31 here, where it says, the Philippines, I think, now probably make a little more sense in regards to why we wanted them so badly, was because what I wasn't saying at the time that Roosevelt commanded the Navy to go there was that we were also, even as early as this period, worried about this... these spheres of influence. So the desire to control the Philippines really is directly related to protecting the open door, which hadn't been announced yet, but protecting our China markets. Well, in 1900, there is a challenge to this when an event called the Boxer Rebellion or Boxer Uprising occurs. The so-called Boxers were Chinese secret society members whose name here, Iho Tuan, can also be written Iho Tuan with a T-U-A-N. And my understanding is that Tuan and Tuan mean both group and militia or hand and band. And the double pun involved implies both martial arts ability as well as like a military militia. Organized a century before, they had originally been an underground anti-emperor's organization. They had opposed the imperial family. But a century later, they resurrect now as a way of defending China and defending the emperors from the outsiders, or from the foreign hairy barbarian devils, as they were called. So what the Righteous Harmonious Fist is another way you'll see it listed in books. The Righteous Harmonious Fists, or the Boxers, and called Boxers because they would often do public displays of martial arts calisthenics in order to intimidate foreigners. They at one time had been a secret society that opposed the imperial government the century before. They re-arose, not so secretly now, as a very vivid example of defending China from outside cultural attack. They didn't like foreigners. They didn't like Europeans and Americans and Japanese, who they felt were carving up their nation.
So, but when they were against the emperor, what?
They were somewhat like a mafia group then. It wasn't just a case of taking over markets, it was also cultural. They believed that Christianity, Republican government, scientific technology, these were all, dangerous ideas and philosophies that would warp and corrupt the Chinese heart. And so they were trying to protect the country from all these outside cultural influences. And their desire was to intimidate both foreigners as well as cooperative Chinese. They would go to Christian missions and not only threaten the missionaries, but the Chinese who had converted to Christianity. A couple of reasons. One is they thought these people were selling themselves out for a bowl of rice, which was in some cases true. but also selling themselves out culturally in their nation by doing so. So if we put that into some kind of thin, bad parallel to the United States, if we had a secret society organization that used terrorism and violence to intimidate people from foreign areas and to scare natives who flirted with foreign culture, what would that be? I'm thinking it would be a parallel to the Klan. Is there a difference? Yeah, China was really being taken over. I mean, some of you may be Klansmen, so I don't mean to, you know, have you slashed by tires or anything, but I think, just teasing. Got the look for that one, sorry about that. But what I'm saying is that I think the Klan is working on a pretty big fantasy here in America, that there is not that much threat from outside culture. Well, we hear a little English language only stuff now and then, but I don't really think we're facing being taken over by foreign cultures and foreign lands. Quite the reverse. We're taking over everybody else. Well, there's been about three different incarnations of the Klan. The original KKK, right after the Civil War, wanted to frighten Northerners who moved south and wanted to frighten African Americans who held government. They wanted to create chaos and run the Union forces off. And while it was racist and anti-black, it was anti-Northern, it was anti-anybody that was going to come down and interfere in the South. That Klan disappears in the 1870s. In 1915, we'll talk about this later, there's a new resurrected Klan, and its purpose is, again, to intimidate African Americans who are serving in World War I, not thinking they'll have rights when they return, but it's also a backlash against, this is where I'm making the parallel, Jewish and Eastern, these Eastern European immigrants that I mentioned. Much of the new Klan was organized to prevent those people from thinking they were equal, anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish, anti-Eastern European. And that Klan starts to dissipate and just about disappear in the 30s. It goes underground and then resurges in the 50s, obviously, against civil rights. So the 20th century Klan, anti-black, yes, but it's also anti-non-WASP. We've defined WASP before, haven't we?
Well, let me ask you this. What's the difference between
the white supremacists and the KKK? Well, there's a group of them. There's the American Nazi Party, there's the Klan, and there's the Cross Sword and Arm of the Lord. There's a number of white supremacist groups that splinter into different factions, but they embrace much of the same ideas. How much of it is close to like Nazi ideology varies.
So. I was just curious because one of the larger ones is a
I think I remember that. And wasn't there a case about those people here back in the early 90s or late 80s that Asa Hutchinson was the prosecutor on? And there was death threats on him when he was here? Portsmouth? Yep. And so that's why I made what's the difference between the people we're talking about here and the Iho Chuan, or the Righteous Harmonious Fists. Well, I'd say the difference is China was really getting carved up. If, like, every coastal city was under the influence of, militarily and commercially under the influence of foreign nations, and Washington, D.C. wasn't strong enough to expel them, then I would be a little more, I wouldn't say sympathetic, but understanding for the purpose of a Klan.
Would be the same idea that the United States
We would call them freedom fighters then. So that's why these boxers were quite popular in China. In fact, they technically were illegal in the eyes of the emperor. They were admired because the imperial family didn't have the power to resist outside influence, but they could watch these terrorists do their thing and kind of hope it would have some impact.
Well, the open door policy was China was getting
It really was.
It was
almost all gone. Yeah, it's kind of like everything at the mall is sold if you don't show up real soon type thing.
So technically the emperor opposed it?
Empress, actually. Yeah, technically because they had been anti-imperial family before, but they resurface now against foreigners, and so it's useful for that. They also realize the trouble that can come from this, because if they get to start killing foreigners, that could trigger, and does in fact, an invasion from outside forces. In May of 1900, that's what occurs. The Boxers begin to really go on the warpath and they start attacking missions. They attacked business ventures and mining operations. One of those was owned by Herbert Hoover, who in 1900 had his mining business attacked by Boxers. He and some of his Chinese Christian employees, took shelter in the basement of their home while the Boxers burned everything upstairs. So he's got some experience with that. They moved to the capital to Peking, and their purpose by attacking Peking was to try to take over all the embassies, the foreign legations. So they moved to Embassy Row and was going to take over the diplomats of Germany and Britain and France and everywhere and hold them hostage. In some ways, I kind of see a parallel to the 1978-79 Iranian hostage crisis, where students took Americans hostages and left the government in kind of an odd way, because the government of Iran did not sanction those students taking hostages until they had to after the fact. So I think the imperial family was in the same mess, that what do they do with these Boxers if they really do take over these foreign embassies? Well, word of this gets out, and all the nations involved send forces to China, the United States included, land on the coast, and this international force works temporarily together to march to Peking and rescue the diplomats before they're all murdered. Not very factually, but kind of closely related to this, is a movie with Charlton Heston in it called 55 Days at Peking, if you've ever seen that, made in the 1950s, but it addresses this issue. That's the theme of the movie, is the Boxer Uprising. So now China is in exactly the spot it didn't want to be. Their capital is occupied by an international foreign military force. And what was feared can now likely happen, and that is, what happens if they just decide to carve up the nation into provinces, conquered territories? It's in response to that threat that John Hay, in item 34 on the next page, sends around a second set of open-door letters or notes. Again, warning these nations, refrain from trying to carve up China after the Boxer Uprising, or you'll face the United States military forces, which will protect Chinese and territorial integrity. We did to rescue our diplomats. Well, they're all there, and while they're all there, we're making the claim, if you try to negotiate away from us and separate this, you'll fight us. Did we have the military power to stand up against all the powers of Europe? So why are we doing this? It's a bluff. It's a jingoistic gamble and bluff that the rest of the world will not want to engage in a major war with the United States over China. And it works. So, or regardless, there's sort of, Dr. Chai also differs with me on that. I think it works. His opinion was that the competition was so bad that nobody could agree on who gets what province, so instead they just settled for a money deal. Element of cynicism in both his answers there. The second round of their letters, again, letters to these same military or political leaders, warning, don't carve up China, respect China's integrity. And so what instead happens is they all demand a monetary indemnity, which equals $333 million, which is supposed to cover the damages caused by the uprising. We even had a share of that, too. $24 million was designated for American damages. But here's an interesting thing. The United States did this. No one else did. In the 1920s, we assessed that only about $12 million of damage truly occurred, so we gave the other $12 million back.
China.
We gave back half of that $24 million back to China after reassessing how much damage had actually occurred. So we're the ones that said don't carve up China twice, the two open door notes. We're the ones that gave back money after damages. I think there's some sincerity involved there. And I read that some of that money that was given back was used to send Chinese students to American universities in the 1920s. And some of those same students who had learned to speak English and American culture were involved in helping the Doolittle Raid, as well as Americans fighting clandestinely in China by speaking English and being translators. Interesting. Well, 36. What effect all this has on China? Prior to the Boxer Uprising, a majority of the Chinese people, whether they're of prominent background and money or not, were sympathetic with the Boxers. A majority of Chinese people were reluctant to accept Western ways. They were, in a block-solid fashion, anti-West, anti-European. But what the Boxers did so embarrassed and endangered their country that after 1900, there starts to be a changing public opinion. Better educated Chinese, especially better educated Chinese who lived abroad, began to say, if we don't start to catch up to the Western ways, at least technologically, maybe not in religion, maybe not in politics, but at least in technology, firepower, industrial power, we're going to be subject to this happening over and over again. So in that respect, the Boxer Uprising shocked many in China and those outside of China to recognize the need to modernize, and one of those is Sun Yat-sen, a Hong Kong-born dentist who learned English and learned his medical skills in Honolulu, who organized donations from Chinese living abroad in Europe and San Francisco and South America, gaining enough money to go back and overthrow the dynasty in 1911 and become the first president of the Republic of China.
So he was the first president?
Mm-hmm. First president of the Republic of China in 1911. And he will, within the first year, give up power to a warlord in order to keep unity, but he'll still remain the major force behind the Chinese Republic until his death in 1925. We'll come back to talking about China and China after Sun Yat-sen as we get into the World War II period to see how Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong are both disciples of Sun Yat-sen. And now to move away from foreign policy, not that I want to. I always love foreign policy best, but talk some about progressive reform or progressivism, which I've got kind of approximately spans the years of 1901 to 1917. Do you hear today people talk about politicians being progressive? You don't hear that term very often? Every once in a while you'll hear a Democrat called, instead of being called a liberal, they'll call themselves a progressive. Any guess why? Because that's an old term. Progressive really goes back to this time period. It sounds better than being a liberal. That's exactly right. Liberals don't win elections. Being called a liberal is you know, conservatives love to be called a conservative. Liberals are too chicken to accept it, so they say, no, I'm a progressive Democrat. It's like saying, no, this is not a tax, this is a revenue enhancement program. Why can't they just tell like it is? But that's, you know, terms come and go. Like, for example, one of the terms that I'm wrestling with lately is the expression people of color. That seems to be gaining, you know, recognition as a proper term. It's amazing how terms of the past become outdated and then replace terms of the present. Progressive is the new polite way of saying someone's a liberal. But the real progressives, let's look at what they did. Progressivism is a movement, a grassroots movement, which surfaces at the turn of the century in response to, as 37 shows, the political corruption, the economic disparity, and the urban poverty that had arisen. Yeah, I'd say maybe a better way to look at this is that period we first talked about, from 1870 to 1900, the Gilded Age. We talked about why it was called the Gilded Age, too, this veneer of gold on top of a lot of trash below. The United States, in that period, just experienced, the reason we don't even study it chronologically, the reason we study it thematically, is because it experiences a lot of unending economic freedom without great government reform movements, without wars. Even the recessions and depressions that come and go are not responded to by government policies. So it's a lot of people accumulating wealth or trying to accumulate wealth uninhibited by the government in that period. And what happens is by the turn of the century, there is a real disparity that breaks out. There's a real gap. The excesses of free market capitalism start to show the strains. In the way of wealth, in fact, did we ever talk about Alger Hiss at all? Alger Hiss, he was an author that wrote Rags to Riches dime novels. His writing and that folklore, I should say, or that popular culture attitude was that your best direction towards making a better life is not to depend on government, but to make it on your own. And that those that depend upon government help are weak and are un-American. That was kind of the popular cultural notion that had led us to the point where at the start of the century, listen to these statistics, 1% of the people own 50% of all the wealth. And the top 12% owned 90% of all the wealth. It is worse now. I saw figures that I was trying to put with this material. I didn't save them, but I hear that the discrepancy of wealth is even worse now than it was back at the end of the 19th century. But it's relative, because 1% owned, well, the people owned 50% of all the wealth, and the top 12% owned 90% of all the wealth. Now, on the other hand, even if you're in the bottom half of all that, if you're living better than you did a decade ago, sound like Ronald Reagan, if you're you're better off than you were 4 years ago. If you're living better than other nations have ever lived, then in a relative sense, you may not feel that. But is that democracy? Is that economic democracy? It's truly not. Now, of course, even saying what I did, I can feel the hackles on your necks coming, oh, he's a socialist. He wants to redistribute all the wealth. I'm not. Yes, I am, but that's not what I'm saying. It's just, if we take it out of it in terms of property ownership, if those kind of statistics are true, what does that say about the honesty of politics problem? It's probably that the wealthiest few buy off a governor, buy off a Senate, buy off a president, a party. So that's the first concern, is this disproportionate amount of wealth accumulation doesn't just make for economic disparity, it also translates probably as a threat to true political democracy. And that was one of the things that progressive reformers complained about. Political corruption was rampant, city, state, national, machine politicians. So there was a call for cleaning things up and making things more democratic. And especially things were, there was a wide gap between people in cities. Urban poverty was far worse than rural poverty, and a lot of that had to do with immigration, with large numbers of people moving into cities faster than they could be cared for. All of this, by the turn of the century, and it has to do with turns of centuries a lot. We went through one of those recently, so you know how, like, at the very end of the 20th century, there was this kind of exhausted feeling like we're just dragged down, and then all of a sudden when Y2K comes along, everybody's new and enthusiastic, and we can reform things, and we have hopes and dreams, and all it is a calendar date change. That same kind of feeling occurred here, that as we moved out of the Gilded Age, all of a sudden we as a nation can do great things. Now, they didn't have it 1901 or 9/11 like we did, that situation. So they were able to focus primarily on the domestic issues rather than foreign policy. How did all these disparities and discrepancies come to be known by people who lived outside of the cities themselves? Well, it comes from journalists in item 38, known as muckrakers. Called that by Theodore Roosevelt from a character in Pilgrim's Progress. The people listed in 38 collectively are known as muckrakers, and they are investigative journalists. 2020, 60 Minutes, that kind of stuff. They, when possible, exposed corrupt politicians or poisonous food being made in the meat packing plants. They're doing this, of course, to expose evil and correct society, but they're also doing it, why? Because it sells. Most of the books that we'll list written by these people were first serialized magazine articles. So what it really is yellow press gone good, if that's a good way to say it. Instead of exaggerating things about the Spanish overseas, we can exaggerate things about our own problems here at home and be considered crusading reformers for it. Lincoln Steffens wrote a book called, in 1910, The Shame of the Cities. The Shame of the Cities by Lincoln Steffens, the first name in our lineup in 38.
Shame of the Cities?
Mm-hmm. And it is an examination of how, what a gap there was between rich and poor. It also exposed how little honest government there was in responding to people's municipal needs. This is a book that examines how much your streets got cleaned from all the trash thrown out if you knew the right politicians and greased the right palms. Same with fire safety standards, police protection, all of it based on whether you're in close enough with the machine politician. Now, a book similar to this, written by an author not listed here, came out in 1890 called How the Other Half Lives by Jacob Riis. R-I-I-S, a Danish immigrant. And this book is half pictorial essay and half commentary, narrative. And I have a copy of it somewhere I dug all last night and couldn't find it. I bought it at the Smithsonian. When I find it, I'll bring it with the War Prayer from Twain. But it's shocking photos, maybe really not so shocking by how things have grown with, again in the cities today, but shocking by what would be considered a Gilded Age paradise for people to come to. Ida Tarbell, in 1904, published The History of the Standard Oil Company. And it is a scathing critique of Rockefeller's cutthroat tactics. History of the Standard Oil Company. The best known author of the Progressive Era is Upton Sinclair, who in 1906 publishes the book The Jungle.
What?
The Jungle. By Upton Sinclair. Frank Norris will write something else here in a minute. Upton Sinclair. Sinclair was a outspoken Socialist Party member. And what he did was interview workers as they left the meatpacking plants each day, take them for a beer and get their stories. And he discovered two things: how much the workers were abused, especially foreign workers, without any kind of worker compensation or protection or safety standards, and how poisonously bad the food and drugs that were coming out of our industries were. And there were no laws, state or federal, to make it illegal to sell this kind of stuff. So what was the rationale behind not regulating businesses that sold poisonous food or drugs? Well, regulation is seen as government tyranny. Laissez-faire is the more respected. And what about the argument, well, what if we get poisoned? What was the defense against that? Yeah, that any company that actually was pumping out bad products is going to lose its market. So therefore, market economics will force them to provide a safe, proper product, which The Jungle showed was not the case at all. In fact, Theodore Roosevelt, reading The Jungle, became so sick to his stomach from what he read that he himself started pushing legislation through Congress to get the first pure food and drug law passed in 1906. Pure Food and Drug Act, 1906, which made it illegal to poison people and lie on the label. What an invasion of business liberty that truly was. Communist at the door. Frank Norris tried to write a three-part trilogy. He got two written, never finished the third, but the first one is the one that sold the most, called The Octopus.
Can you spell that?
O-C-T-O-P-U-S? And The Octopus, like the animal octopus.
Oh, octopus.
Yeah. And what this was about was how monopolistic railroads in California so ripped off wheat farmers. So it dealt specifically with California railroads, but it was really the railroad industry at large that's under attack in this book. Jack London is not usually known for being a muckraking writer. He's more of a naturalist, social Darwinist, and Marxist. But his book, The Iron Heel, is a look at how badly labor was treated and how weak unions were compared to factory owners. Heel, like the heel of our foot. Iron heel.
How bad
working conditions were when you try to organize a union, what would happen to you in the factories.
What was the name of the book?
The Iron Heel. Yes, same one. No doubt, people probably, I'm not saying he's one of them, but people probably jumped on the bandwagon and tried to put together either a series or a book about reform things because it sold. So, is it so wrong to make money on a good cause? There's a lot of people thought about that and jumped into it.
The octopus was about what, though?
California railroads that manipulated wheat farmers.
Oh,
Ray Stannard Baker, the last name in our list, and there's many more authors we can put in, but the last name in the list that I've put together. Ray Stannard Baker is the only author to address the racial issues concerning African Americans. His book's called Following the Color Line. Following the Color Line. Why in this first two decades of the 20th century, if there is a grassroots call for reform to clean up corruption and unfairness and lack of justice and things, why do so few, he being the only one, address the issue of racism?
Most of them are racist.
I think that's an answer one we can work with. Maybe not violent ones, but maybe it just wasn't seen as an issue that was a major reform need. So yes, it may well be that a majority of these people are not racially sensitive. In fact, it's obvious that in some of these reformers, their major answers to reform would be keep immigrants out. So yes, they are white supremacists in some cases. Not all of them, but some of them. Let's try to be a little forgiving if we can. What also might, if there wasn't that they're hardcore racist, what might also be the answer? Didn't think about that. Didn't think about that at all. That's probably a very accurate answer, that even if they were concerned and saw the injustice, that was an issue like gay rights or something that isn't going to sell at that time period. That could well be the case. What I was looking for more was this. When do we start seeing, well, first of all, let's back up and say this. The progressive movement is urban, Midwestern, Northeast. In fact, one person said, when you look at the who's involved, it's populists shave their beard, clean up, and go north to the cities and become progressives. So in northern cities, how many African Americans did you see? Very few. That won't start until World War I in the 1920s. After about 1950, 1960, that's when you see the great migration of African Americans from southern locations, but very, very few black people living in northern cities. So therefore, it's one of those things where if you don't live there and you don't see it, and it's on the other part of the country, it's easy to forget those things. So that may be one of the explanations, but racial insensitivity is also one. Well, everybody keeps looking at the clock and looking at me, so I feel your pain. And we'll go ahead and pause. Pick up with item 39 when we return.